Welcome to CR Amplified, the Cairo Reviews podcast where we talk to experts and policymakers about relevant issues on the world stage. I'm Jordi Yassin. Today we're joined by Dr. AJ Bauer and Dr. Paola Chakravarti, who will be discussing their recent forum on media and fascism. Dr. Bauer is an assistant professor in the Department of Journalism and Creative Media at the University of Alabama. His essays have appeared in outlets like The Guardian, American Journalism, and The New Inquiry. Dr. Chakravarti is James Weldon Johnson Associate Professor at the Gallatin School and the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication at New York University. She has written several books on media and politics and is the editor of the journal Communication, Culture, and Critique. The forum that will be discussed in this episode was published in Communication, Culture, and Critique in June of this year and features several articles on the relationship between media and fascism in the US today. Hello, Dr. Bauer and Dr. Chakravarti. So first, I'd just like to begin by asking you to give me a bit of background on the forum itself.
Do you want me to start, AJ?
Yeah, you can get started since you started it, and I can.
So yes, we formed a new editorial collective to guide the objectives of the journal, Communication, Culture, and Critique, which was the editorial was collective was set up in September of last academic year, so September 2024. And from the beginning, the idea was to use forums to address more topical concerns of the day. And so more, you know, pressing, urgent kinds of concerns that are harder to address through the peer review structure, you know, which takes much longer. And so one of the first things we did in the journal was we, I think we're the first journal as far as I know in our field that published a solidarity statement on the genocide in Gaza, and that was in our first issue. We also, in that first issue, had a discussion thinking about comparative authoritarianism and the media, which AJ actually edited, since AJ's a scholar of media and the right in the U.S., and that was a conversation that AJ facilitated with Srirupa Roy, who's an editorial collective member who works on India, and Veronica Gago, who's also an editorial collective member who works on Argentina. And so that was looking more at the kind of political facet of the rise of the of right-wing authoritarianism and the relationship between media and right-wing populist politics. You know, we felt that there was a need to also talk about the political economic dimensions of the rise of the right, specifically thinking about the election of Donald Trump in, you know, this year. It feels like it's been many years already, but just this year. And so this second forum was a more focused attempt to think about the political economic context of thinking about media and authoritarianism, the rise of the right in the U.S., specifically around the elections of November of 2024. So that's the background. And we brought together an interdisciplinary range of scholars to address a range of issues, and we can talk more about that. AJ, you should add whatever I missed.
Yeah, and so another part of the forum that we tried to do was focus on the experiences of communities who are particularly affected by the incoming and now Trump regime. So we've got a couple of contributors that are focusing on Trump's rhetoric and policies around transgender people, as well as immigrants, migrants, other folks who are facing undue pressure at the moment. So the journal is obviously Communication and Cultural Studies, but so there are some that are kind of about media strategy as well. But we were trying to be deliberate about prioritizing populations that are feeling the brunt even more than the rest of us, perhaps, the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. I did want to ask about Trump's role in all of this, because he does come up a lot in the articles in the forum. So I wanted to ask why he is such a strong representation of far-right leanings that we're seeing almost everywhere now.
I think One of the things that is so interesting about Trump is his kind of willingness to push against norms and other kinds of cultural and political expectations. And I think that his doing so, obviously in the U.S. context, is kind of undermining our democratic institutions in a way that is really problematic and probably will be irreversible or very difficult to reverse. But I think that a lot of other leaders around the world see in him kind of a license that they can then point to him and say, hey, you know, I can violate norms or institutions here too if Trump can do it, vice versa. I also think that Trump has been, perhaps even more so than in previous U.S. presidents, has been willing to look at other examples of right authoritarian leaders across the globe and get inspiration. A lot of what he's been doing to crack down on universities in the United States, for example, draws really heavily from a playbook that was developed by Viktor Orban in Hungary. A lot of his anti-migrant policies and kind of, you know, the kind of bombing of ships in, or boats rather, off the coast of Venezuela, right? That's kind of using warfare methods to target drug cartels, etc. In some ways borrows from the Duterte regime in the Philippines, right? Who's no longer in power, but nevertheless is an inspiration to Trump. And so I think it kind of cuts both ways, that Trump is a form of kind of license for a lot of right-wing authoritarians across the globe, but he's also drawing from their example as well.
Yeah, and I would just add that, I mean, for us, the focus is on Trump because, you know, the journal itself is a global journal, but many of us are based in the U.S., in the U.S. Academy. International Communications Association, which hosts the journal, is based in the U.S. But I think more importantly, you know, we have to think of the U.S.'s role as an imperial force, and think about Trump and the rise of Trump in the global context, not just in relation to other figures like Trump in, you know, Modi or Bolsonaro, et cetera, but we have to think about the role of the U.S., which certainly under different iterations of liberalism also practiced kinds of authoritarian and extrajudicial violence in the global South. But there is something now when, you know, we see perhaps the decline of certain forms of American legitimacy and American imperialism in the world. You see the rawness of this you know, overt power and overt violence, which is, you know, something that is worth noting, right? And worth thinking about and worth thinking through. And so, you know, the focus on Trump and the focus on the U.S. is not just a national question, but the, you know, it speaks to the broader geopolitics of American imperial power, which precedes Trump and will last us post Trump, you know? And so I think that's something that, at least in our introductory essay, that we also wanted to think through, right? That we want to think about this moment. There's many things about the Trump regime that is exceptional, but the focus of thinking about, you know, the politics of the moment, is to also situate it in longer lineages where you've had these kind of contradictions between American commitments to democracy and freedom of information and liberalism on the one hand, and yet its exercise of brute power and violence, both within the U.S. against subjugated minority communities, but also against much of the world, right? Much of the world in terms of the global majority in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and what we call the Middle East. So, yeah, so that's, you know, another reason why we focus on Trump.
Can you talk to me a bit about specifically his use of alternative media, social media, new media during his, well, actually both of his electoral campaigns?
Yeah, so in some regards, this is somewhat of an older phenomenon. There's been a long history in the U.S. of presidents and others running for president using new and other forms of alternative media to get around the mainstream press. A good historical example of this is the Roosevelt administration during the New Deal. Most of the newspapers were opposed to the New Deal. And so Franklin Roosevelt went on the air with his famous fireside chats on the radio to speak directly to the American people. I think that you could see Trump's use of social media, especially Twitter, as kind of similar in the sense that, especially when he ran in 2015 into 2016, he wasn't taken all that seriously. There was conservatives within the conservative movement who opposed him. That was the kind of short-lived Never Trump phenomenon, which lingers on in the kind of the Bulwark today, which is kind of a center-right, formerly a neoconservative Weekly Standard that's converted into kind of a more liberal-friendly in some ways outlet. But Trump, because he was seen as unserious and seen as kind of volatile and a threat to American traditions and norms, had to use those kind of alternative media in order to get around and reach his followers. I think what you saw, and Reese Peck writes about this in our forum, that one of the things that Trump did in 2016 was he relied heavily on podcasts and other alternative kind of right-wing influencers to get his voice across and around. And to the point that by 2020 and 2024, right, when he was running for president again and again, he was able to go back to the well, basically, right? He had already developed a relationship with those podcasters, with those audiences. And so this partly explains why somebody like a Kamala Harris, who did try to employ alternative media and podcasts and whatnot in the 2024 election, according to Peck, right, didn't quite land, right? She was relatively new to those audiences, hadn't spent the time cultivating that relationship. So sometimes I think when we think about media, we tend to think about it in a very old-fashioned kind of unidirectional way, kind of a hypodermic needle, right? That people simply passively consume whatever media it is. So the idea there is that if Trump is on alternative media, that people that listen to alternative media are simply buying and consuming it, right? But I think that it's really important to think about the role of alternative media in that it creates a distinction between the media that the people are consuming and some other media, right? The whole alternative means that there's some legacy or mainstream media that it's referring to. So the benefit of right-wing media that Trump was able to capitalize on was not just that there were right-wing media outlets. It was also that there is what I call a critical disposition toward the mainstream press that causes those conservatives to invest in right-wing outlets, trust them more, and be skeptical of those mainstream outlets, which might have been more critical of Trump. You don't have exactly that same dynamic among liberals in the United States, which is one reason why somebody like Harris, as Peck writes, didn't have quite the same ability to leverage those newer platforms.
Yeah, and I would just add on the alternative media. I mean, one of the other dimensions of this is, of course, the role of big tech in shaping the rise of the Trump agenda, especially this second time round, is something that I would just want to get their names correct. Something that Farkas and Mondon, Johan Farkas and Aurelian Mondon, in their article in called "The Roots of Reactionary Tech Oligarchy and the Need for Radical Democratic Alternatives," address, and we address this a little bit in our intro essay as well, which is, you know, the seeming disparity between a tech industry that, you know, through the 1990s and the first two decades of this century has been aligned with more socially liberal causes. I mean, you'll remember the role of many tech companies lining up after the George Floyd assassination, calling for racial justice in their own ways, et cetera, standing up for things like abortion rights or for immigration rights. And those same tech companies now transmute into a cultural right wing authoritarian stance. And, they trace how you get from one to the other. And I think this has, you know, a lot to do with the political economic structure of the tech industry, which has been allowed to expand into all dimensions of our lives in a way that is unregulated, and that in a way that is very dangerous for democracy. So the kind of the agreement between a liberal order and a neoliberal tech oligarchy that seemed to hold in a certain kind of reasonable way, which of course had a lot of inequalities and a lot of violence that, you know, we didn't see as clearly as we see today, gave way to this, neoliberal and authoritarian present that we're in, right? And so I think it's important to trace how, you don't have this kind of exceptional turn into an authoritarian present, but increasingly from the 1990s, the lack of regulation, the lack of public say over what these tech companies can do, within the U.S. and transnationally, has led us to this moment where, increasingly around the world, democratic orders are threatened by big tech. So, that's an important part of the story to trace as well.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to actually discuss that article that you're mentioning now a bit more in depth. I mean, is that what is meant when the article says what it calls liberal post-democracy has given rise to this kind of authoritarian system, especially with regards to tech?
I mean, we're speaking to you at the Cairo Review, so I think I can, talk to you. We can think about the moment of the Arab uprisings, and we can think about Tahrir Square, and this moment in which there was a lot of, I think, wild assumptions about the role of corporate big tech in shaping our democratic futures. As I'm sure you know, the Tahrir Square and the Arab uprisings were often called things like the Facebook revolution, right? And so in many parts of the world, not just in the Middle East, but, in many parts of the global South, there is an assumption that's often advertised and, heightened by these corporate actors themselves and corporate media, that corporate technology allows a kind of democratic freedom, a democratic freedom against state authoritarian power, right? But in fact, while, there's some truth in terms of, certain contexts, like the context in 2011 that allowed for, grassroots movements and student movements and labor movements and other types of minoritized groups to rise up and use these platforms at a certain juncture, it isn't the technology itself or the benevolence of these tech companies that leads to those kinds of democratic outcomes. And as we saw in the Arab world and places like where you are based and elsewhere in the Middle East, that period was followed by mass repression, and that repression was also accepted happily by the big tech companies, who had supposedly gifted the part of the world with democracy and revolution. And so I think what the authors in this paper, and I think, increasingly there's a realization. I mean, this is something that I think critical scholars of tech for decades have been warning us about, that this promise of liberalism as a gift that big tech, holds for us, despite its enormous social power in society, despite the fact that it, circumvents any kind of regulatory effort, any kind of institutional checks to its power, both domestically and internationally, the arguments that critics, I think, have made for decades are playing out today, right? And so therefore, you see in the world that we live in that the kind of neoliberal enclosure, where one of the things you can't democratically discuss is the regulation of tech itself. One of the things that you can't talk about is the future of our political economic futures. Those things are sort of cordoned off. That kind of cordoning off of political economic realities leads to more autocratic futures. In fact, it's not a future anymore. It's the present, right? And so that's the lineage that this article and I think other work that takes a more critical position on tech, has laid out. And so, yeah, it seems counterintuitive in a world where, for decades, certain social actors have promoted the idea that freedom is technological freedom. And I think, you know, we have to do a lot of work to sort of rethink the assumptions of that formulation. I'm sure AJ has more to add.
Yeah, and I think that another thing that I think these more critical approaches are doing is pulling back from the kind of more abstract and idealized ways that we've tended to talk about the internet and talk about social media in the last, say, 20 years. And to get back to something that is more concerned with kind of what are the balance of forces and how does that shape the way that different kinds of tech functions, right? So, for example, when we're talking about Twitter today, we're not talking about the same Twitter that existed in 2016 or 2011, right? During the Arab Spring or during the, you know, Occupy Wall Street movement, right? These movements that were, that leveraged, Twitter and other social media so well against authoritarian regimes, right? You see, especially in the wake of that, increasing collaboration between platforms and authoritarian governments, as well as increasing kind of development of alternative kind of internets, right, with, you know, firewalls and whatnot, say China or Russia, that blocks users or makes friction for users to be able to use these kind of more liberatory technologies. But another thing that you see, especially since 2016, is when Donald Trump won the presidency in the U.S., there was kind of an uptick of what I like to call kind of a mis- and disinformation paradigm, right? The idea here was the reason that he won, the reason why Brexit happened in the UK, the reason for a variety of other kind of authoritarian elections kind of around the world was a circulation of mis- and disinformation that was kind of tricking people into voting against their interest, right? That was the kind of dominant narrative. And so, as a result of that, many tech companies, so Facebook or Meta, Google, Twitter did this initially as well, started adding safeguards, right, to try to prevent for the spread of hate speech and other kinds of, you know, mis- and disinformation that resulted in negative externalities in terms of voting and whatnot. And there was a pretty considerable backlash to that, especially by 2019, 2020, and is continuing today. Where a lot of those platforms felt burned, right, by the fact that, they implemented all these things. Biden won in 2020. After Biden's win, there was a series of kind of right wing tech growth. So platforms like Parler, Getter, which I don't think exists anymore, and then Truth Social, right, which is the Donald Trump promoted app. And so the creation of those alternative apps created additional pressure on the mainstream omnibus apps to basically re-platform right-wing actors, and also to scale back their kind of mis- and disinformation regulations and safeguards that they implemented, especially once Trump won again, right? And now they're all wanting to parlay or curry favor with him, right? So I think it's important when we think about tech to think about not just these kind of idealized technical applications, the way the tech industry tends to talk about it, and really talk about where the rubber meets the road. Obviously, as Paula mentioned, the U.S. is not engaged in any regulation effectively of the tech sector, including in terms of mergers and acquisitions and whatnot. And so as a result of that, the tech sector is more concerned with preventing the government from regulating them. And so we'll line up with any politician, right or left, that's willing to give them what they want.
The opening article of the forum, the one that was written by you, mentions Elon Musk, also an interesting dimension. So can you talk to me a bit about how he plays into this environment?
I feel like you have more to say probably about Elon Musk than I do, but I guess I would say that to me the racial dimension here is important. I think one of the things that what so the title of our essay is called "Cruel Capitalism," and for me this was a play off of the idea of cool capitalism, which is a kind of an argument that was made by economic sociologists Boltanski and Chappello in a book called *The New Spirit of Capitalism* that was quite influential in the early part of the century, which was basically tracking the way that corporations in the latter half of the 20th century and into the 21st century went from being top-down kind of organizations to embracing some of the critiques of the 1970s, end of 1960s student movements, where corporations themselves transformed to become Less hierarchical, and CEOs emerged as to be become these, you know, instead of, you know, these buttoned down corporate patriarchs, they became a kind of cool capitalist, right? They reinvented their image as passionate entrepreneurs, you know, and the language of entrepreneurialism is really crucial to the neoliberal transformation. And what we see today with tech, with the merging of a kind of fascist politics and a tech entrepreneurial culture, is really the revelation that these cool capitalists are actually cruel capitalists, you know, that there is a underneath these kind of socially progressive transformations of capital, you actually have a different history. For example, one in which, you know, promoters of a kind of neoliberal economic future have always embraced arguments of social Darwinism, of eugenics, of these notions that certain people in society are wealthy because they are more capable and competent, and that certain people end up poor and in, you know, socially vulnerable positions, not because of the social systems that protect them or that offer them opportunities, but actually having to do more with innate qualities, often based on very old but then repackaged notions of racial hierarchy, of gender differences, and of nationality and ethnicity and religion. And so this kind of repackaging of a racial logic, which goes back to the 19th century and goes back to European and American colonial justifications for the racial reordering of the world, are repackaged today in these kinds of neoliberal corporate cultures. And so, you know, to me, the fact that you have a white South African immigrant who embraces the Trump agenda and, you know, wields that chainsaw that we talk about, right? The chainsaw, which is representative of cutting down the Amazonian rainforest and decimating indigenous peoples of Brazil and Argentina, you know, is not accidental, right? The settler colonial histories of countries like Brazil, Argentina, the U.S., South Africa, and Israel, among others, you know, come to the fore in the kind of world that these cruel capitalists imagine. And I think Elon Musk, you know, now the richest man in the, you know, universe, is of course a great representative of that kind of cruelty and violence that we see on display every day in this country and elsewhere. Yeah, so I'll leave it at that. I didn't speak that much to Elon Musk, but to me that's the context, right? The cruelty of this kind of world order that assumes that certain people, you know, deserve suffering, deserve because of who they are. So yeah, AJ, you might want to add.
Yeah. And so I think one of the fun things about putting this particular piece together, insofar as writing about fascism can be fun, is Paula was coming at it from the cruel capitalism perspective. But when I heard that, I was thinking about Lauren Berlant's cruel optimism. And I think that Elon Musk sits kind of right at the edge of these two concepts very, very nicely, which is why he became kind of somebody that we led with. In addition to being the fact that he was at the time that we wrote this earlier this year, which again feels like 10 years ago now, he was in the government. You know, he was involved in a massive cost-cutting initiative that he called Doge, which he named after his favorite cryptocurrency. What cruel optimism is this idea that you've got optimism that kind of capitalism provides for you about, you know, the benefits of meritocracy, or in the case of Elon Musk, this kind of, you know, science fiction utopic vision of, you know, the best and the brightest coming together, you know, without any government regulation, importantly, right? And with, you know, government funds that are never paid back, to create, you know, a mission to Mars or these other kinds of, you know, vision, quote unquote, visionary, technological dreams, right? And part of what we wanted to emphasize is that the reason that Musk had been so celebrated, even among liberals and some leftist people that were not on the right, was because of this kind of utopic vision, right? And the possible, positive outcomes for humanity, right? And the longevity of humanity with like colonizing Mars or whatever it would be. But part of what we wanted to point out is that these dreams of utopic visions that Musk has in place is also a valorization of hierarchy, right? And this speaks to the kind of racialization that Paula was talking about, right? It posits, even if not explicitly, implicitly, racial, gender, other types of hierarchies, where the good, capable people are rewarded. And we won't say all that much about the other folks, right, is the way that that narrative tends to go. But part of what we wanted to emphasize as well is that for even the people that are, quote unquote, benefiting from the kind of fascism promoted by Trump and by Musk, the benefits are also inhibiting their human flourishing, right? Which is part of Berlant's idea of cruel optimism. The idea here is that the government, as it was scaling back and cutting funds and things like that, was cutting funds that were also inhibiting the ability of the government to provide resources for the very people that voted for Trump and the very people that support Elon Musk's vision for Mars and this sort of thing. And so part of what we were arguing, and again, getting back to the chainsaw metaphor, right, is that some of the kind of more horrific and violent outcomes of Trump and Musk's cuts, right? So cuts to healthcare and food stamps or SNAP benefits, right, for lower income people. The harassment and arrest of people who, not even people who are undocumented, just immigrants in the country who, happen to not be white, right? And so look, quote unquote, suspect and then are taken up and picked up by ICE, right? All of these kinds of authoritarian crackdowns and limits are also providing kind of almost like a televisual experience for many of the people that support Trump that allows them to feel some kind of pleasure, right? Pleasure at the quote unquote bad people suffering and the good quote unquote good people thriving, right? Now, all of those processes, especially and including the ICE, the increasing kind of militarization of the United States by the Trump administration, is also coming back and biting the people that are celebrating the ICE raids as well, right? They are also going to be victim of an increasing authoritarian country that has the capacity to police at scale. And so even the folks who seem that they're benefiting or think that they're benefiting from the Trump administration, that quote unquote benefit is a fleeting benefit, right? It might be a kind of salve on top of the authoritarianism that comes for us all at the end. Anyway, that's all I got to say, I think, about that for now.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would just add is that, many of our articles, also in addition to looking at the cruelty, also imagine more radical democratic futures. And so, the authors in our collection are doing something, for example, that the Democratic Party in this country is not doing, right? Zoran Mamdani and the left aside of the party, which is imagining a normative worldview that is oppositional and antithetic to this, this horrendous and cruel and limiting and diminishing understanding of politics. And so the Naomi Paik's piece, for example, on abolitionist sanctuary makes, I think, an important case connecting the George Floyd uprisings to the movement for sanctuary and immigrant justice, which is that, the opposite to criminalizing migrants based on, racist assumptions about good versus bad migrants is not to say we should be arresting and kidnapping and deporting immigrants who committed some minor infraction, like got a parking ticket or, were late on a domestic, on a divorce payment. Sorry, I'm forgetting what the word is. What is that called?
Like an alimony or a child support.
Like an alimony payment, mm-hmm. child support payment, or, any sort of minor or other types of infractions, that the solution is not separating the good from the bad migrant, right? And the solution is not criminalizing certain groups of people. And you know, she makes, I think, a compelling case for this notion of an abolitionist sanctuary. And the language of abolition became, you know, very widely embraced in the George Floyd uprising moment in the U.S. and around the world. The George Floyd moment was a moment of protest that was global. And, you know, we do have to see this moment today as a reaction, right? A reactionary moment that came in the aftermath of a series of uprisings, perhaps beginning in the 21st century with the Arab uprisings, which was an anti-colonial type of uprising, and going all the way, you know, you have repression, but you have these continued types of uprisings, right? Which rise up against racial hierarchies and colonialism and economic inequality and authoritarianism, and then you have this kind of repression. And so, you know, presenting a normative vision for a democratic vision that is more radical than what we, you know, the confines that we live in, I think is also important. And I think several of our articles try and do that.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things in the articles was what the one article discussing the underrepresentation of Christian Zionism in U.S. media. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask about how that fits into this overarching theme of contemporary fascism, basically.
Yeah.
For sure, yeah. So so the contribution you were mentioning by Gil Hochberg is basically prioritizing. So a lot of the focus on Zionism in the U.S. and globally is focused on Israel and the state of Israel. But a really important kind of component of global Zionism is Christian Zionism and its support for the Israeli state, with kind of peculiar and one could say anti-Semitic kind of assumptions underwriting it, right? The idea there is that a lot of Christian Zionists want Jewish folks to be in control in the Middle East, partly because they think that the rebuilding of a second temple will, you know, initiate the end of the world, right? And so this is a idea that in the midterm, right, is a supportive of a Jewish state in Israel. Towards the end, though, of ultimately, you know, Jesus coming back, and in that, you know, philosophy, right, Jewish folks presumably being cast into the hellfire or whatever it would be, right? And so, part of what that piece is pointing to is that, Zionism as a project, is in many ways promoted in advance. The reason why the, state of Israel has been able to be so successful with getting funds from the United States to engage in its settler colonial project, in Palestine is because of its ability to convince these Christian Zionists, right, to basically go along and support their mission. One other thing that I'll add about how this has played out in U.S. politics that I think has been really unfortunate is that in the U.S., there's a hyper fixation on electoralism, so electoral politics. And so I would argue too much of the Gaza genocide has been filtered through a you know, vote for Democrats or vote for Republicans lens, which is a problem partly because the Democratic Party, especially under Biden, was full-throatedly in favor of the Gaza genocide, right? Extremely resistant to ceasefires and other kinds of mitigation efforts, basically allowing Netanyahu and the Israeli government to do whatever they saw fit. And so I think that one of the negative outcomes of that in terms of U.S. discourse is that you see a lot of, it's almost perverse, like gloating, right, among certain corners of the Democratic Party, especially now that Trump is in power and is kind of promising, or at least in some corners, promising to kind of, you know, auction off Gaza to the highest bidder and to, you know, displace Palestinians perpetually, right? There's a kind of, well, see what you did. You should have voted blue, right? You should have voted for Harris, and that somehow would have made the Palestinians' lives different or better, right? And so I think that we're really stumped in the U.S. context by a very constrained discourse that can't really see atrocity committed by the U.S. and U.S. supported states across the globe in any other terms other than point scoring in a domestic political electoral circumstance. And so I think that's the kind of, that's where we're at in the United States in terms of the discourse. That and the kind of violent crackdowns under both Biden and Trump now against activists who were supporting the Palestinians and opposing the genocide.
Yeah, I'll just add, I mean, that was a really good answer. I will just add one small note. Part of, I think, what Gil Hushberg, who is the chair of the Middle East Studies Department at Columbia University, which has been, of course, the, you know, the site of a lot of political attention in the last few years. One of the things that I think she's doing that's important is having us problematize the way that anti-Semitism has been used as a cudgel to silence critics of a genocide, right? And also to make invisible anti-Zionist Jews who are in alliance and solidarity. Certainly in the U.S. diaspora and certainly among younger Jewish populations, our students, etc., who have played an important role in calling for the end of the genocide, for calling for a different kind of future in Palestine. So I think pointing to the way that anti-Semitism has been used as a cudgel, as AJ is pointing out, both by the Democrats, right, because the Democrats are the ones under whom this kind of unprecedented repression of speech on our campuses and in the publishing world, in the media, the horrific silence on the Gaza genocide as it was playing out in places like the New York Times and elsewhere. That was done in the name of protecting anti-Semitism, right? But what she's showing is that both the liberal use and the authoritarian fascist use of this are equally problematic in the way that it lets off the hook the Christian fundamentalist, white supremacist, Zionists who are rooted in a kind of colonial understanding of the world, right? A racist and colonial understanding of the world. So I think unpacking that is really, really important. And this piece is actually the piece that probably was read the most out of all of the pieces in our forum. And I think it's a really brave and important piece, for making that argument, which, of course, today under Trump, you have, complete repression, not just of speech and activism around the genocide in Gaza, but actually around all forms of political dissent on our university campuses. Even in our city streets, right? And so, I think speaking to this issue has, broader, implications, certainly in the U.S. and in many parts of the West.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then just one last thing, another really stark depiction of that dynamic is, lately, you see right-wing anti-Semites, right-wing Christian Zionist, and or not Zionist, Christian anti-Semites, people like Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene. Marjorie Taylor Greene of the conspiracy that Jews control a space laser that controls the weather, right? Both of those folks have made statements nominally in favor of Palestinians, or at least against the Israeli genocide. And I've seen some colleagues of mine on the left and friends on the left who've been like, oh, these people, maybe they're people we can ally with, right? But I think that one of the things that Gil's piece points to, and that I think is worth reiterating, is that that does, just because they're speaking out against the genocide, right, doesn't necessarily mean they're people we need to build alliances with, right? That, as Paula mentioned, they still do subscribe to racist and colonial visions of the world that would be totally happy with, the destruction of Palestinian people. They also just happen to think that Jewish folks should also be destroyed, right? I think once you peel back the kind of baseline assumptions of, anti-Semitism versus Zionism and things like that, you start to be able to see much more clearly that these kind of more subtle forms of political alliance and why they present risks.
I wanted to end by asking you guys if there's any specific thing that you found interesting that you'd like to highlight, anything you want to add.
Maybe we should talk about Cass's piece.
And yeah, I was thinking about
how. And the two pieces on transgender.
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah, I think that So one thing I had mentioned earlier was after the 2016 election, there was this big emphasis on mis and disinformation and fact checking, right? And part of the presumption there is that there's a lot of people with some misapprehensions, and that we just need to go and confront them on those misapprehensions. Once they understand the truth, then we can get, you know, back to business, or whatever it would be. And I think that, Cass Adair's piece, from our series, I think does a really good job of pushing back against that. From a perspective of, you know, what does it mean for a trans person to constantly feel the need or the imperative to debunk, or to prove their worth or their existence? It's quite exhausting. And to expect that of folks is very limiting as a political project, right? And I think one of the really important critical moves that that piece does is it says, what if instead of constantly responding to the constant onslaught of bad faith, mis and disinformation about the trans community, trying to convince some ambiguous liberal public that actually trans people ought to be defended, what does it look like to envision a trans-focused politics that is about trans flourishing and about carving out space, even at kind of more of a micro level, to allow for trans people to exist, which is in this country, in the United States, and in many countries at this point, is a radical act these days, right? It shouldn't be, but it's the way that, you know, the government's kind of restriction and cracking down on trans people, forced detransition. You know, finding ways that we can engage in a politics around gender that doesn't put folks like that in a position where they're constantly having to engage in politics to survive, but which they can carve out a space where they can live in spite of the, you know, severe state repression that they're facing. And so I thought that that was also a nice piece that was thinking about the contemporary, but also engaging in kind of a visioning that we see very absent in a Democratic Party, which at this moment is basically trying to figure out how best to throw trans people under the bus so that they can get elected, right? Given that they see that as a toxic issue.
I guess I would add one thing since you asked, what would you add? Which is, you know, I think one of the things we're trying to do here is, you know, A, to say that this is fascism, right? The fact that, you know, it may not feel like fascism from the 1930s and 40s, for all people involved. But for, you know, that we are defining this as a kind of fascist, a turn to fascism, a turn to, you know, authoritarianism, but that we're also warning that perhaps the ways in which fascism was understood, you know, why, how did Europe get to fascism in the 1930s? How that question was answered by European intellectuals in the aftermath is something that, you know, I think we are questioning. And so, I mean, in the piece we talk about Aimé Césaire, and we reference the work of Denise Ferreira da Silva, that asks us, and, you know, we talk about Fanon, we talk about Gramsci, you know, we talk about the scholars for whom there was not a clear distinction between this kind of liberal democracy at home and authoritarian violence abroad in the form of colonialism and colonial violence, colonial extermination, colonial genocide. And so I think that's very important for us, because, you know, to explain this moment as a moment of irrationality in a lineage of rational liberal democratic politics where the Fourth Estate worked great and everything was super, you know, until Trump came along, shockingly, in 2016, is what we want to get away from, you know, and we really want to think about the colonial capitalist racial origins of this moment and that kind of lineage. And, you know, that's the hope with the different pieces coming together. So, you know, so I would also just add that as a sort of additional point.
I think that's a poignant point to end on. I really, really want to thank you for this discussion. Your answers were really, really insightful.
Thanks for having us.
That concludes this episode of CR Amplified on media and fascism. I'd like to thank Dr. Bauer and Dr. Chakravarti for their thoughtful insights and for taking the time to speak with me. That's all. Thanks for tuning in.